Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, a not-for-profit credit union with 21 branch locations and a full suite of digital services, inviting listeners to recognize and appreciate the contributions of Washington State's dedicated public employees during the month of May. More information at WSECU.org.
The first time Carolyn Sofer laid eyes on her church's new home, she had a few second thoughts.
I came up and looked at it before he looked at it, and I said, ooh, I don't think we want that. That looks like a bus depot from Mississippi. So, because it didn't look anything. It was run down.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect. And we're in a storefront space in Skyway, just north of Renton, with co-pastors Carolyn and Menard Sofer.
It was something that you would never, ever want to. It was horrible, because this was like a tavern. And I won't even tell you all the paraphernalia that was on the walls. You can just imagine. Yeah. And I'm just saying, a lady's eyes shouldn't behold all of this, you know. My kid said, Dad has lost his mind, because it was horrible looking. But he had a vision.
The black walls were painted white, the paraphernalia disposed of, and this den of sin was transformed into something a bit more wholesome.
This was a dance floor. Here, all the way back to that pole, that last pole back there, he had it cut back, and this became a perfect pulpit area.
But just because the dance floor was gone did not mean the music disappeared. In fact, the Sofers say their music was kind of what made this space into a church. This is what they call sacred steel, a gospel style centered around the lap steel guitar. It's specific to certain Pentecostal traditions, including the Church of God in Christ. Early in the 20th century, the mostly black churches often couldn't afford an organ.
Basically, they had was washpans, washboards, tambourines. They didn't have a chordal instrument, unless you found a piano, which they refer to as a piano. And many of those were out of tune, with broken strings. And so, being that the way it was, the guitar fit in because it was very mobile.
Now, Menard Sofer is teaching his son, also named Menard, to play the steel guitar. On Sundays, their son-in-law plays bass, everybody sings, and the storefront church is filled with the music of sacred steel. This week on Sound Effect, our theme is sacred spaces. A church, a mosque, a garden, a bedroom. The places we create to escape the day-to-day and to get in touch with something deeper. So Carolyn and Menard Sofer's church, New Birth Ministries, began in Seattle's Capitol Hill. They moved to Skyway in the late 1990s and found that they had their work cut out for them.
There's a sign that's outside of our building. It said, pray for what?
Peace.
Peace in where?
In Skyway.
This is Skyway. Shootings have occurred. They left shells on the parking lot. They found people who were hurt at our doorstep. But we were yet maintaining a facility, a place to make a difference.
Soon after New Birth arrived, other churches followed, then even more. Now, Skyway has more than 40 different churches, all for an unincorporated area with about 16,000 people.
Okay, so you want to sort of describe where we are?
Yeah.
This is the Skyway West Hill area. And this is Church Mecca.
Carolyn Sofer takes me on a quick tour of this stretch of Renton Avenue, where about 14 churches cluster.
We were the second one that came here in 1998. There's one right there. See where it says Greater Gospel Temple? There's two churches that are in that building. This is another church. This is the former dollar store. It's 2 to 3 churches in meeting here. This church over here has 2 churches that meet here. Used to be 3 because it was a Hispanic church. And let's keep walking. So we've counted how many so far?
Oh, I don't know, 10 maybe?
Not yet. We're getting there, though. We're getting there. That's the old grocery store. That big building over there. There's 3 churches in there.
3.
And right, we probably won't walk down there, but you see where it says Bible Study Outreach Ministries? There's 2 churches in there. This space is for sale right here. They're trying to get another church in. Since the dentist's office, I think they've been advertising this space as would make a great church.
Why do you think so many churches have relocated here?
One thing, availability, space. This is the last frontier. Because property is so expensive in Seattle. Everything has been priced out of Seattle. This is the last frontier. This is King County unincorporated. So they've got a lot of these buildings that are vacant, and so churches come in here and they rent.
You must understand that many people don't live in Seattle anymore, especially people of color. They're in Renton,
Most of them are in Kent, Auburn, Federal Way. We've been here so long. Until when we moved here, there was still quite a few, African Americans living in the Central District. So this seemed so far out. Now, this is close in.
Has the property values that have pushed a lot of people to move from Seattle here, have those forces started to move in here too, into Skyway? Is it still affordable?
It's gone up. Even our building, from when we purchased it to the price that it is now.
It's not the values. It is the taxes.
The taxes are eating us up.
The issue is the opportunity of access.
Yeah. To make an impact. Yeah.
To make a positive impact. Down here, they've had some fatalities. A lot of shell cases were spent in this area.
You know, 2 were just killed here. Did you know that?
I did hear that,
yeah.
Where are you pointing right now?
Right there.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Right next door to where we're standing.
Yeah.
We get ready to come to church, and it'll be taped off up there. Great surprise. It makes us have to pray more.
And then there was a 3rd shooting that was in relation to that at the Rainier Beach track meet. That guy was classmates with my kids, and he was killed right in front of his children.
I just wonder if, with all the changes, the community, particularly African-American communities in this area, there's a lot of turmoil in terms of people getting priced out, gentrified, and displaced,
right.
And going to different places, trying to find their place, and so on. What role do these churches, you think, play in kind of providing some stability and holding the community together?
They provide hope, provide a sense of family, a sense of connection. You know, we didn't give you all of the churches yet.
I just got a taste?
Yeah, the old library is a church now. One block going this way, there's another church that has
churches. Sacred spaces here. My lamb, they are here.
One more time.
Sacred space is here. Sacred space is here.
Carolyn and Menard Sofer are the pastors at New Birth Ministries Church in Skyway, and thanks to Max Wasserman for his help on this story.
Sacred space is here. With my lamb.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, you're listening to Sound Effect, and today it's stories of sacred spaces. The musician Phil Elverum made his name in Olympia's music scene back in the early 2000s, recording under the name The Microphones. And his music has always evoked a sense of place. The Pacific Northwest landscape shows up again and again in his songs. Elverum now records under the name Mount Erie, which is also a landmark near his hometown of Anacortes. He used to record in an old Catholic church in town, but Elverum's life and music changed forever in 2016. That was the year his wife died. He released two albums intensely focused on death and loss. 88.5's Will James visited Elverum in the tiny room in his house where he recorded those last two albums. All the music you'll hear while they talk is by Phil Elverum or his late wife, Genevieve.
Not much. It's really small.
It's small. This house is from 1907. Or, no, 1905. Anyway, this is a very old house. It's been well maintained. But yeah, this is the master bedroom. But we've never used it as a bedroom. It's always been sort of miscellaneous production room or something. So at the moment, it has a drum set, kind of half a drum set, and a couple of guitar amps. A little tiny writing desk. It's a spare room. And this was the room where Genevieve died. Not to get too abruptly heavy, but yeah, during the last like week of her life, when finally hospice came in, this was the room where they set up the hospital bed that they brought in. And it happened quickly. I met her in 2003, and we lived together in Anacortes as weirdo artists that didn't have real jobs, and we've just had this great life. But also we wanted a kid, but it just wasn't happening. And then finally she was pregnant in 2014, and we had our daughter in January 2015. And then 4 months later, Genevieve, my wife, she went in for a regular like postpartum checkup and had some mild abdominal pain, and they found cancer. We immediately went from like this bubble of early parenthood into driving to Seattle to go to different specialists and different scans, and also trying to figure out insurance and money, and meanwhile also trying to figure out who can watch the baby while we're doing all this. And I went into autopilot, just managing all of this, and Genevieve went into a different kind of autopilot where she was trying to save her own life. I would never have expected that she would take this turn into deep mysticism. And it was disorienting, but I didn't blame her at all. It was just a surprise, because that wasn't who she was before. So that room across the hall was her studio. She had a big drawing desk in there, and she would just be in there listening to like meditations and chants on YouTube and working on art projects. And she got really into the tarot. For most of the time I knew her, she was superstitious but not spiritual, so omnipresent crows, that's another part of my life, speaking of superstitious. But she found a kind of peace and sanctuary in her practices. The hard part of that was that it swept her completely away from us. As we were living in the house with her, she wasn't really available. And she was aware of that too, her like isolation in her trying to heal and trying to meditate and trying to just find peace and let go of all the negativity that she'd carried around in her life and try and solve all of her emotional struggles and forgive all wounds. And just like, she was trying to just live and trying to heal everything, not just cancer, but like her whole mind and body. She threw everything into it, and I think did find peace in it, although it was a huge, like, fighting kind of peace. And she did the extreme hardcore chemo and also all the alternative things. She just threw everything at it. And she lasted longer, probably, than she was supposed to. It's a fast-killing cancer, usually. And she lasted for 13 months and then died in July 2016. And here we are. Well, there was a period after she died where I didn't want to go in here, and I just kept the window open and the door closed, and I even took the screen off the window and had it like as wide open as possible, and for maybe a month I just wanted to like air it out, neutralize the room, and let whatever thoughts and feelings were in here dissipate. And then I came back in, and there was like leaves and water, and like birds had been in here. And that felt good, actually. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna turn it back into an inside space now. It felt like a change had happened. It felt like, I don't know why it felt good, but it did. Yes, like something had taken place. After a little while, I was like, I want to go back in there and sort of burrow into these things. I want to stop avoiding them, but actually digest it. And so that's when I made these songs and recorded them in here. That felt good. It felt like, well, avoiding it's not going to be the way out. Maybe going through, burrowing through this difficult stuff would be the way out. Kind of has been.
When you record a song, are you singing to someone?
Yeah, it's always Genevieve. I've been very aware that the you in the songs is her, and I've been thinking a lot lately, because now these records are done and I'm kind of done playing shows about them, or of them, and now I'm butting up against, okay, well, what now? Is the you still going to be her? And what does it mean if it's not her anymore? Who? What does it mean to like let her dissipate into not being addressed anymore in song? But yeah, it's definitely been to her. I sing to you, Genevieve. I sing to you. You don't exist. I sing to you though. Maybe on a subconscious level, the immediacy and the bluntness of it comes from the fact that I recorded them in this house and in this room.
You've sung about this house feeling haunted or being a haunted house. Mm. Does it still feel like that?
No, and I used the word haunted knowing that it has a whole, like, all these connotations and baggage behind it, which is bad. Most people don't want to be in a haunted house, but it has never felt bad. It's like benevolently, kindly haunted, like we're being held, kind of. More just that this house is full of memories. This was our house and our life, and it's still, it's like her stuff is still, I haven't totally gotten rid of it all. And so haunted is maybe not the right word, but that's the only word we have for this. I recorded all these songs about the echoes in our house now, and walked out the door to play them on a stage. But I sing to you. I picture you. When we first met, you were 22. I drove my truck onto the ferry to Victoria in the morning, where we met and talked forever in your apartment with evening falling.
So I brought my blankets in and slept on the floor right next to your bed. In the morning, barely awake, I saw you standing right above me, peeling an orange and looking hungry. Do you want some? You asked me and then just avalanched into me with pieces of orange and weight and kissing and certainty. I remember you a few days later in Tofino, where we'd driven to play a show. You'd set up for us at a surf shop to no one. Then we slept in the back of my truck and got woken up by the cops, and so went down to the fishing boat docks to ask whoever for a ride across the water to Mears Island to just get left there for the day. And we did. Brought some food to eat and went through the big trees, abandoned and in love, totally insane, apart from the rest of the world. We had finally found each other in the universe, lying on the rocks waiting for the boat to come pick us up. I read the one book we had with us aloud, with my head on your lap, sinking in bed in French. And we thought of devotion and snow and distant longing in the Himalayan air, high and cold with a bell ringing out.
That story from 88.5's Will James. This song is from Mount Erie's newest album called Now Only. A new book of poetry by the late Genevieve Elverum comes out later this month.
And right before you died, 13 years later in our house, I remember.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today our theme is sacred spaces. Museums all over the world have showcased the work of Seattle artist Ginny Ruffner. Ruffner makes these fantastical sculptures out of glass and metal. She's illustrated books and created huge public art pieces, including a 28-foot-tall flower pot at 7th and Union in downtown Seattle. In 1996, Ginny moved into a brick building in the heart of Seattle's old Ballard neighborhood. When she first moved in, the backyard looked like typical big city blight. There was overgrown crabgrass and weeds, trash, a brick wall.
My view here was pretty urban, so I made my view. I augmented it, added to it.
It can take a little bit of work to understand Ginny, but it's worth it, and we'll explain why in just a bit. But first, I have to tell you about this space. Over the years, Ginny has filled it with serpentine vines and garish flowers and a million shades of green, with punches of red from bleeding heart and geraniums. A Tasmanian tree fern stretches up 12 feet tall. Ginny wraps its trunk in the colder months and refers to her as Cindy Lou Who. In one corner, ivy pours over the statue of a face, like hair. This garden is surprising and eclectic, a lot like Ginny.
I love my garden. It's my favorite place in the whole world. It feeds my soul.
If people are picturing, like, some raised beds in the backyard, you're mistaken. This is a whole different kind of space. So we're right smack in the middle of historic Ballard. Mm-hmm. There's lots of stuff going on around us. The buildings are built cheek by jowl. But you've got this enclosed space that's not visible from the street, that it's like another world.
Well, that's exactly what I want it to be. It's kind of my secret garden, and it's really my oasis. I want it to complement the historic, beautiful nature of the neighborhood, but also provide me with a respite, a place to go and be.
Ginny is a petite woman with a cascade of curly white hair. She laughs a lot, and she knows the way that she talks can throw people off.
It doesn't happen so much anymore, but I've been cut off when I go into a bar before I even order a drink. They say, when I order something, she'll say, "Oh, honey, don't you want a Coca-Cola?"
Because they think, they assume you're sloshed already. Ginny is not drunk. In December of 1991, Ginny was a rock star in the art world. She was illustrating New Yorker covers and making glass art for Absolut Vodka and selling her pieces for thousands of dollars. And then she was in a head-on car accident. Doctors thought she'd be in a vegetative state for the rest of her life.
And then put me in a coma, 5 weeks, hospital 5 months, wheelchair 5 years.
When Ginny woke up from her coma, she says her mind was like an empty house that she had to move back into, slowly. Physically, all she could do was move her right thumb. She also had to learn how to talk again. At the beginning, she couldn't even make a sound.
And it was really very Helen Keller, the way I learned to talk. My speech therapist put my hand on her throat, and she talked. And then immediately I could make noise. It was just really amazing. I mean, it was definitely put an end to any aspirations for an opera singing career I had.
Well, I can imagine that the recovery must have been a really grueling and very long process. Did this space connect to that or help you through that?
Absolutely. I can't really say how, but it is definitely helpful for that. Just to be around beauty wherever you find it makes you better, I think.
We get interrupted by some of the garden's resident wildlife.
You hear the birds. Mama Robin just flew into the nest. Up on the fan.
Oh, her nest is on your ceiling fan,
yeah,
up there.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, man.
There she is. Well, last year I had 5 sequential robin's nests.
Today, Ginny's mind and irreverent humor are as sharp as they were before the accident. When Ginny isn't zipping around on her Segway, she walks with a cane and oversees the thriving art career that she rebuilt after the crash. Many of her glass pieces are some interpretation of a plant, whether it's a glass bouquet of traditional-looking flowers or blue glass flowers set in bronze that look like alien life forms. The classical and the peculiar emerge from the same imagination. And then there are the larger works. Many of Ginny's sculptures that have toured museums are now dotted throughout her backyard oasis.
Well, this is kind of a sculpture graveyard back here. That's the thing about making big stuff, is often, well, I'm a very prolific artist, and I may often make large-scale things that I end up owning, I'll put it that way. And so I'll put them in the backyard, like the big chain.
An enormous steel chain is draped above the garden, looking like King Kong's leash.
It's about 50 feet long.
Oh, my. Each link is, what, about 2 feet or so?
Yeah. It was part of an exhibition called the Flowering Tornado.
Well, I was noticing that the sculpture and the plants are so intertwined, it's sort of hard to see where one ends and the other begins.
Well, that's because plants are so persistent. They're more adamant about, this is my territory. So they will take over, given it's on a different time scale, but they will assert their dominance.
Ginny loves that plants are always changing and adapting to their surroundings, which is something she can relate to more than most of us. To see a before picture of Ginny Ruffner's garden and what it looks like today, you can go to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. And there you'll also find photos of a few of the plant-like creations she's made out of metal and glass. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and next on our Sacred Spaces show, we leave the East Side and head to the coast to Oysterville, Washington, about 15 miles from Long Beach. It used to be a big center of, surprise, oyster farming. It's a tiny town with an even tinier church, but this church has a very long history in Washington as a little seaside haven.
My great-grandfather was the co-founder of Oysterville in 1854.
That's Sidney Stevens, great-granddaughter of R.H. Espy. And he didn't just help create this town, he also built its church, the same church she's sitting in right now, called the Historic Church of Oysterville.
He was a staunch Baptist. The Baptists began meeting early on, as early as 1863, but they met in whatever the largest home was. And by the time when Espy built his house, that was the most commodious home in Oysterville. And so the Baptists met there. And I think he finally just got tired of that. And he donated $1,500 and this piece of land for the building of the church. The big deal was to have a baptismal font indoors.
A baptismal font, just in case you don't know, is a big round basin that holds water so you can do baptisms inside rather than having to use an outdoor body of water.
So the first service was held, I think, in November of 1892, and there was one baptism that was, they were ready to baptize, and I think it was actually the preacher's daughter. So the service takes place, the baptism is done. The women later come back to clean up the church and discover that there was no drain in the baptismal font. And so they had to bucket brigade all the water out. And there was never another baptism held in the church. They went back to the bay, which I love.
This was in 1892, about 38 years after the founding of Oysterville. And while the town had a new church, the oysters had started to become scarce. The prosperity receded and the town started to get very quiet. But the church kept its doors open.
And they had two or three different preachers that came. But it was like now. It's not everybody that wants to live here on the coast in, you know, this rural area. And it was the same in 1890s. And so it was hard to keep preachers. Then we have a ghost, and she was the wife of a very questionable preacher that came here, she drowned in the bay, and they tried to get the preacher for an inquest, but he split with another man's wife.
The 1930s saw the last regular services at the church, and by the time the 50s rolled around, the church was rarely used. It fell into neglect. Then in the 60s, Sidney Stevens' mother started digging around, and she found something out.
The deed to the property and the building was that if the church did not continue to be used on a regular basis after X number of years, I don't know, 10 years or something, it would revert to the family.
So that's what happened. And in 1981, the Stevens family had the church rededicated and then gifted it to the Oysterville Restoration Foundation. In fact, the entire town of Oysterville is on the National Historic Register. It has been restored, although it still has no electricity or plumbing, just a little potbelly furnace for heat where the baptismal font used to be. There are hardwood floors, 8 rows of wooden pews, 2 pump organs, and a piano. But in the 125 years that the church has been open, one thing has been consistent.
In all of that time, I don't think that, you know, it never occurred to anybody to lock the door.
That's right. Visitors have been able to come and go as they please 24 hours a day for over a century.
When I see the door, somebody's left the door open, I trudge across the street and close it or whatever.
The guest book in the foyer suggests that the church sees about 10,000 visitors a year, from as close as a couple of miles away to, recently, as far as Iceland. Despite being open at all hours, the church rarely gets a nighttime visitor. Again, no electricity inside, and Oysterville doesn't even have any streetlights. Sidney Stevens says that vandalism over the years has been pretty minimal, and she says that it's far more likely that somebody leaves a gift rather than takes something.
Yeah, there was no bathroom facility, and occasionally people would, you know, complain a little bit about that. And then one day in the poor box, in the donation box, there was a $500 check with a note from someone. And she said, this is toward the outhouse that you need to have in the back. And eventually we do now have a kind of a fake outhouse, and it's a shell around a Santa can.
If you visit Oysterville today, you can still find fresh oysters. And Stephen says that the church and the parsonage across the street that she now lives in are just as synonymous with the history of this town as the oysters are.
Okay, in one way, it symbolizes Oysterville to me. In a way, both the church and the house, even more so, are like members of my family. I often think, how would I feel if something dire happened to this building? And I don't know. It would be like losing a member of your family, really. So, you know, they say you shouldn't be so concerned about physical things. But, you know, the church is almost beyond a physical thing to me. It has it's not only a symbol of a spiritual arena of life, but it has a personality.
Sydney Stevens lives in Oysterville. To see pictures of the Oysterville Church, you can go to our website, knkxsoundeffect.org. And thanks to Damian Mullenix for his reporting on this story. You're listening to Sound Effect from 88.5. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and we're talking today about sacred spaces. The Islamic Center of the East Side is Bellevue's only mosque, and it was at this sacred space that Muslims prayed five times a day. I say prayed, past tense, because the mosque is no longer there.
Developing now, a live look at the burned-out Bellevue Mosque, where investigators are still on scene searching for the cause of a second fire in just over 1 year. New cell phone video shows the house of prayer in flames earlier tonight.
That's right. The mosque was the target of arson not once, but twice. That clip was from Como News. Now, the fire-blackened ruins of the mosque are being demolished. I went to meet Omer Lone there. He's an elder at the mosque and lives just around the corner. We stand at the edge of the fenced-off site where an excavator moves debris with a giant claw. Lone says the first fire was a traumatic experience for the community. And then when the second fire happened less than a year later, he says he could hardly believe it.
The second arson, I was at my work, and when I got the text, I was like, hold on, how it doesn't make any sense. So I immediately rushed to the place, and we realized it is the old facility, which is already, you know, right now we are not using it. And then as we were here, so many questions running through our mind and heart. Well, why would somebody do it? Because the building was not in any use. There was no gas, there was no electricity, so no way it could have happened by itself.
By that time, as you said, you were already out of the building. It was, you know, you were figuring out what life without this building was going to be like and so on. It was vacant. So what was it like then for you, given that you had kind of already... Yes. Detached from it to some extent.
Right. So the more than the detachment, there was a bigger question that it was asking. The question was, you were torched first time, now you're torched again. Is this a pattern that will continue to happen? Why is this happening? You know, there's so many questions in our minds that we're running through. So is this what we have to face and prepare for? So this was a bigger question. It was not about the building that was on fire was already torched, but it was about the bigger question that it exposed.
And that must tap into people's anxieties.
Definitely
anyway.
It was making people worried, and you know, they got scared as well, thinking that, okay, if this is the pattern, then it means a lot.
That must have been hard to know how to feel, I imagine. In each case, it didn't look like it was necessarily motivated by hate or religious animus or whatever, but then again, you did get targeted two times.
Yes, the main thing here is, you know, the emotions and the attachment that a Muslim has with the mosque, because the mosque being, it's a symbol of Muslims. And it's that attachment, regardless of the reason, what caused the fire. the loss of the mosque in itself is a great calamity for the Muslims in general. So the emotions were coming from that aspect of it, rather than it was a hate or non-hate. It's just the attachment that we have with the mosque and the value it has in our lives. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim.
We're in a storefront a few miles away where the Islamic Center has rented space. A giant prayer mat carpet covers the floor, angled toward Mecca. Omar is chanting from the first chapter of the Quran, giving thanks and praise to God. He says that people from more than 40 different countries pray here as they wait for a new mosque to be constructed.
Different races, different tribes, different cultures, but we come together as a single team, and we always, you know, pray together and spend time together and participate in all the programs together. I mean, the mosque plays the role of the community center, you know, helping out and making programs for the shelter programs, the food programs for poor and needy and refugees and homeless, the counseling programs for families, counseling programs for youth, for teen, and the great role that also plays is, you know, people who are the newcomers to the faith or even people who have questions, want to know about Islam, want to know about Holy Quran. And it is a place where that education is imparted to them.
Does the mosque mean anything different in a place where you're a minority religion than it does, you know, back home where Islam is everywhere?
If you look into the mosque and its importance, when the Prophet of Islam, Muhammad, peace be upon him, when he migrated from Mecca to Medina, the first thing that he did, he didn't build his home. The first thing that he did is to build the mosque. And it is the central place for the Muslims. They don't only pray, but this is the university. This is the town hall. You take care of the poor and the orphans. You take care of the sick of the community. You plan for them. You establish a center there. So it means, at every place, it means a lot to Muslim. It doesn't matter whether this is, you are living as a minority. The functionally, a mosque is supposed to play the same role that it has to play anywhere else.
Well, in the wake of the fires, what was the reaction of the broader community like, the community outside of the mosque?
Well, one thing that I can never forget in my life is the overwhelming support that was provided by the broader community outside the faith. And I still remember the cards that were made by the kids of the community who don't follow the Islamic faith. But as good neighbors, the kids, the messages, the support that they had shown, and the elderly people of the community, they walking in the cold days and mornings with the flowers in their hands, tears in their eyes, it was an amazing thing to see.
Are people scared?
Yes, there are elements, you know, there are questions. Like, as we are talking about the construction projects, people want it to be secure, which implies that people have that fear in their mind.
How do you counsel people to sort of deal with the anxiety that comes from having this had happened twice to your mosque?
So we tell them that, you know, the majority of the people that we are living in, they are very tolerant. They don't subscribe to any of the propagandas that is being created. But it only takes one crazy mind to make a mess.
So what do you hope for the new building? Do you think that things will feel any different being back in that space than they were earlier?
Yeah, certainly it is. It is, you know, feeling, it's the feeling of home. After the mosque is restored, we have a great role to play to explain what we Muslims are about by speaking about it, to demonstrate it by living a life, by showing the example of the Prophet that he has left us with. And I'm very sure and hopeful, as people will know about it, they would realize, you know, the beauty of the religion.
Well, thank you so very much. I really appreciate your time, Omar.
thanks a lot for having me on your program.
Omer Lone, an elder at the Islamic Center of the East Side in Bellevue, he says they hope a new mosque will be completed in the next 12 to 18 months. To wrap up our show on sacred spaces, we thought we'd spend a couple of minutes with some sacred music. Seattle Pro Musica, the acclaimed choir, wraps up its 45th season tonight with a program called Sacred Ground. They describe it as choral music exploring our spiritual relationship with the natural world. The program takes place at St. James Cathedral in Seattle, a church known not only for hosting Catholic services, but also for its physical and acoustic beauty. Here's Seattle Pro Musica Artistic Director Karen Thomas.
We stand in the middle of the cathedral around the altar, so the choir is in a big circle, and the sound just goes up from the choir. It goes right up into this big round oculus that's above us, and it spins around and blends, and it is just the most amazingly glorious, like enveloping, beautiful, beautiful sound. I get shivers when I think about how amazing it is to just be in the midst of that and hear all those voices blending together in that space.
That's Seattle Pro Musica rehearsing at St. James Cathedral. They'll perform their final show of the season there tonight at 8 p.m. And that's where we'll leave it today. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Monica Spain. Our intern is Janae Janik. We had help this week from Will James, Max Wasserman, Ed Ronco, and Damian Mullenix. Aaron Hennessy is our executive producer. We'd like to welcome a new member of the Sound Effect team. Our producer, Posey Gruner, expanded her repertoire by producing a human being this week. Oza Faye Viers, a 7-pound, 12-ounce future radio nerd, was born Tuesday morning with a full head of hair. Love and congratulations to Posey, Sarah, and Oza. Sound Effect is available as a free podcast, of course. You can find us on iTunes or your smart speaker or wherever you get your audio. We are especially grateful for reviews and ratings on iTunes, or you can send your feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. Come on back next week when our theme is Picking Up the Pieces. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is 88.5 KNKX.